Hi there, you're listening to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates, and I'm here with trumpeter and composer Dave Douglas.
Hey, Michael, how's it going?
Good to be back.
It is good to be back, and we'll be listening to and talking to Matt Mitchell today, pianist. That was what we were just listening to, yeah. And Matt has been playing in my band and plays with Tim Byrne and 15 million other people.
Great
musician. Hey, it's Dave Douglas calling from A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. Thanks for making the time to talk to us.
Of course. Thank you for calling.
Man, I loved hearing these duo pieces between you and Chess Smith.
Thank you. Thanks. We had a good time doing it.
So this is a studio recording that you're putting out later this year, is that what?
Yes. We recorded at Josh Roseman's studio in Williamsburg.
Right. What does he call it? 58 North 6th?
Yeah, the Louvre.
So the Louvre. Scrutable Labs or something.
Scrutable Labs, yeah, yeah.
How did you guys start doing this?
Well, basically, I started in like June of 2010 writing these little short pieces for myself as just a way to kind of sort of push, like generate my own material to sort of push my piano playing and my improvising and my composing kind of all at once. And basically for the purpose of I didn't have to, basically just I was only writing them for myself, so I didn't really have to take any sort of outside considerations into account, I didn't have to worry about whether or not anyone could play them, that sort of thing, and just with the idea of I know that I'm not going to be able to immediately play these, these are things to practice, sort of taking a long view, So, I've kept writing these things. They're really short pieces, like 1-2 pages, generally not more than 20 bars and sometimes as short as 6 bars or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, so what I would do is I would on tour with, Tim Byrne's band, Snake Oil, Chess and I, or I would use these as warm-ups during sound checks, when I would get to know whatever piano I was stuck with that night. and so Chess would just sort of, after a while, as a joke, just started kind of playing along with what I was playing, without really knowing what I was playing. And usually it actually sounded really good. It sounded like an improvisation or whatever. So, I told him what I was doing and he expressed interest in kind of taking a look at it. So the irony of it is that I wrote them without the intent of worrying about whether or not anyone could play them. And now I've convinced someone to play them sort of unintentionally, at first. And then, after a while, we just started working on them, really just shedding them really hard. We spent a long time on some of these, so...
Did you ever give him the charts?
Oh yeah, he has the charts, totally. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So basically, I just give him my scores,
Right.
I just give him the piano score, and he just improvises his part. Hmm. So, the first several of them, the first 5 or 6 of them, it's they're all these pieces are sort of in a similar zone in terms of complexity and sort of approach. So a lot of it was just sort of us learning how to learn the pieces, and then each subsequent one is a little less. I mean, they're always kind of challenging, but each one is a little less, of a shock. You know?
That wasn't intentional in the way you wrote them. That's just by the experience of learning them, it gets easier to learn them.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like anytime you spend a lot of time with a group of pieces by one person, you know, mm-hmm. you notice certain things. If it's unfamiliar, it might be unfamiliar at first, but then after a while, you notice certain things. Right. I've noticed this with Tim's music. You know, Tim's music was definitely like, I've been listening to it for years. When I first started playing it, when I saw it on the page, it was just like, oh, wow, this is, you know, harder than I thought it would be, you know. But then after a while, I get used to it, and, you know, now after several years of playing a bunch of his music, you know.
It's a walk in the park.
You're just sight-reading the whole thing at this
point. You
got
it now.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, so.
I mean, that is some of the hardest music I ever played, for sure, some of Tim's stuff.
Yeah. You know, and it's you know, and even after, I mean, I still have to spend time with it. There's, you know, anything new that he gives me. It's not like I can instantly play it, but the time is definitely cut down from when I first started doing it.
But what know, also for me, you know, I've seen that band a number of times, and what's amazing is just how effortless everybody seems to play that music now. You know, it's really beautiful.
I appreciate that. I mean, I guess it's cool that it seems effortless. I can tell you that there was a lot of effort early on and you know, I think it's typical with his bands too. You know, like there's some growing pains, and then, you know, and like he said, you almost have to have a few bad gigs, you know, to kind of iron the kinks out.
Well,
or
you
whatever.
You guys are like the David Blaine of jazz, because it looks effortless from the outside.
We're the Lords of Illusion, yes.
So okay, so back to these etudes, like
right.
you talk about each of them having some kind of particular challenge for you as a player.
Sure.
So what, like I hear obviously a lot of the rhythmic stuff that's going on is really challenging. But is there anything, you know, can you give me an example of what you mean?
I guess the one they called veins. That's more of like, I conceived of that as like a perpetual motion kind of exercise that has a lot of certain kind of leaps. I guess one thing I could say before I say this is that I still conceive of them as like, you know, if I would play them differently if I was playing them in like a recital as like solo piano pieces.
Oh.
Like I would play some of them, like I actually don't, most for the most part, don't include tempos like on purpose, because I view it as like, you know, that sort of thing can be totally open. You know, you can play them this. A good view is to play them as fast and as clear as possible, you know, but you know, that changes from etude to etude.
Mm-hmm.
But like some of them I conceive of like that one number 30, I think that's number 33.
Mm-hmm.
Basically if I was playing that by myself, I try to keep it as, you know, it's got a lot of leaps in it. And I use that as one of my, like if I have like about only 5 minutes to warm, I've used it as warm ups on sound checks on your gigs.
Yeah. I hear you doing it and I try to say nothing.
Right. You mean like you'd have to fight the urge to tell me to play something else or something?
No.
No, I know.
It's so fascinating. I don't want you to stop. And I know if I come over and say something stupid, then you'll stop and then it'll end.
Oh, no. I mean, that one I actually know so well that I can sort of do it while talking to other people or whatever. I mean, that's it. But yeah, so what I'll do is I'll just, you know, that one has these gigantic leaps that I, you know, and sort of hand orientation kind of things that I, you know, that I wrote into it, you know. I actually, that was one, that was like the, sort of the, one of the last ones that I thought would be a good one to play with Chess. I was like, some of them don't immediately present an idea to me of like, oh, this would sound good with drums, you know, or I should improvise on this, but actually that one sort of provided a nice contrast to a lot of the more kind of, you know, thorny, you know, etudes, which have more messed up rhythms, you know?
So what are some of the more messed up rhythms you're working on there?
I mean, there's another one I sent you, number 16, which I think I called Singe. That's probably the hardest one that we played together, because that, the left hand, it's in, I wrote it in 4/4 or 2/2 or whatever, and the left hand is all septuplets, and then the left hand's all quintuplets, and the right hand is all septuplets.
Mm.
So it's like simultaneous 7 and 5
right.
The whole time. So wow. I'm playing both, and then Chess sort of goes back and forth between one and the other. One thing I'll say about the improvising on all these is that we don't really discuss too much about how we improvise on them.
Mm-hmm.
So we did several takes of that one. And that one, he just kind of goes back and forth. Sometimes he'll play both pulses, and sometimes he'll play a portion of the cycle in one pulse and then switch to the other one. And so that's sort of like, and you know, and it's like 5 against 7, that's something I hadn't really, at the time of writing it, hadn't really explored at all. But I wanted to see, you know, a lot of it's just seeing if things are worth checking out, you know.
Interesting.
Or worth it to me, I should say.
Do you play them first, or do you write them on paper first?
I always, with pretty much all my composing, I write them on paper first, and then I'll just, away from the piano, actually. Yeah. I don't write at the piano. If it's nice outside, I'll write in the park, or if it's cold, I'll write in a coffee shop or something like that.
And do you always need a piece of paper to write, or is it sometimes just...
Yeah, I always compose, most of the time, like 99% of the time, I compose pencil to paper, yeah. There's always some sort of like, chicken scratch scrawl version of these pieces on paper.
Right.
And then I'll put them in the computer,
So like,
I always check my work though, just in case I don't mean, it's not like I write it and then it's done. I mean, I'll look and I'll double check it on the piano just to make sure I like it,
Revise.
I mean, I've gone through some periods like where I will write something or I'll write myself into a corner and then I won't know what to do, so I'll just stop and just leave it for like one. And there's been a couple of pieces where I'll like leave them. I've left them for like a year and just done something else. And then I was like, then I figured out exactly how I wanted to finish it. And then I just go and finish it, But cool. For the most part, yeah, I just most of what comes out on the paper actually kind of makes it to the final stage.
Wow, great.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How much do you think the problems that you encounter in writing these etudes you apply to other situations where you might be playing, normal is the wrong word, but you might be in other situations where this isn't actually written in, but is it a language that you find you can bring in to those situations?
I think so, in varying ways. I mean... part of it for me, and I'm, now that you ask the question, it's sort of causing me to frame things in a little bit more concrete ways that I hadn't really realized that I thought this way. But a lot of the point of this process for me, I would say, it's like, when I practice, practicing for me is a good time to like zero in on really specific things, and in such a way that I wouldn't really want to think of when I'm in a situation where I'm improvising. Mm-hmm. When I'm improvising, I generally just go, I kind of just barrel forth, and just kind of, I play and without getting all sort of mystical, I try to enter that realm of like sort of the unconscious and trying to deal with that,
Mm-hmm.
But when I practice, I try to like zero in on certain things. So they become sort of, I try to internalize them in such a way that they just become part of the language. And then certain things will come out when I improvise. But I would say I would definitely say a lot of the fruits of all this they definitely have emerged in all sorts of situations, whether it's with Tim's band or your band. With your band.
I mean, actually. I hear you doing things with my music that, of course I wouldn't have envisioned as the composer, and that's as it should be. Everybody should be bringing something of their own and something new. But I also hear that, what you're doing is different than what anybody else would bring to the music. And, it takes the band into some really interesting places. So, maybe the question isn't so much whether you're doing that consciously as a result of the etudes, but whether you feel having written and recorded these etudes affects the way that you operate in a band situation like that.
I think maybe now, that recording was just from December. So that might be, that sort of phase is, sort of just beginning or in the early stages. I think probably, especially now that because now they have a life beyond the fact that they're just these exercises for myself, now these pieces have a life of their own. I mean, we just played a gig a couple of weeks ago and it was interesting playing that stuff on the gig after having done this recording because the pieces now I mean, you know, have all this different sort of, we've kind of, or we're still taking them into different directions. Like I said, we don't really talk about, except in the most general sense, how to improvise on them. So we're already kind of, you know, we're not being too precious with it, you know.
Yeah,
we're kind of.
And oftentimes, I think sometimes once you do a recording like that, it's like, okay, so there's the document. I'm now free. I can go and do whatever I want with this stuff because we've got it. And now let's see
right.
what else we can do. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And I would say in the studio, our approach was the same. We just played them, and it just so happens that with the advantage of a perfect piano and really mm-hmm. nice vintage drums and cymbals, we just, you know, what we got to was a little different than if we were playing live at Corso or something, you know.
right.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, you know, when we do play live at Corso, I like to, once we're comfortable enough with it, I like to slap the tunes around, you know. I like to, you know, kind of have my way with them and just sort of deal with them in different ways, you know.
What about Id Balm? Can you talk about that for a sec?
Yeah, so that's a that originally, my original idea was that was something that is to be played with one hand only.
Huh.
Like just it's all little dyads, and you could. Yeah, they're all intervals. I think the biggest interval might be like a ninth or something like that, but it all moves kind of quickly. So that was the original concept. I play with two hands in the recording, and then we just sort of, you know, a lot of these we kind of improvise over like a form, like in the jazz sense, you know, which I found kind of interesting. And actually that's a first take too. That's the only take
wow.
we did of that tune. That's a pretty tough one because every bar is a completely different rhythm. Like every bar is a different time signature and a different like tuplet over it of some sort.
Wow.
So kind of just feeling the learning the rhythms and playing the flow in the right way, you know.
We're going to play that and check that out.
Absolutely. Do you have to shift gears much from, say, this music, and Tim's music, which is what I've heard you do most, and then, you know, you hear, say, Dave's album, like the Be Still track, and it's so melodic and so, you know, pretty and, you know, functional harmony, and, you know, your personality's
right.
still there, but it's very, you know, tonal, beautiful. Is there a shifting gears that has to happen when you hear something like that or play something like that?
No, it's not. I know what you mean, and I mean, in some ways, I mean, yeah, it's a different mindset, but it's not. I mean, the first music I ever listened to, the first music I ever realized that I loved, when I was just barely old enough to even be aware of what that meant, you know, was like pop music, like
right.
the Beatles and Stevie Wonder, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, my parents had some good records. And they played that stuff, you know. And so I realized really, really young that I loved that sort of thing. So, I mean, and I still, I mean, I've never abandoned that, really. It's just,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I still love melodies, you know, and pop music and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I mean, I think part of me, and also, you know, I still love to play, you know, the lineage of jazz is also important to me too. I mean, you know, I mean, I've spent a lot of time listening to Keith Jarrett and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's certainly a precedent for, I would say, the way I play on that track, definitely pro, you know, it's hard to discount his sort of influence on that, I would say.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Sure. Thanks for deciding to talk to me.
And great. And those etudes are absolutely stunning. And the recording sounds amazing.
Oh, I appreciate it.
So that was great to talk to Matt. And it's interesting that it brought up Tim Byrne. We heard a little bit of his music with Matt playing it, but one of the things that I thought would be interesting to play on the podcast would be some other music of Tim's that was influential, I think, maybe for both of us.
Sure.
Tim
sure.
was a real mentor for me in the late 80s, early 90s, and this record, Fractured Fairy Tales, also had one of my favorite trumpet players.
Herb Robertson.
I learned a lot from, yeah, Herb Robertson. So
nice.
Here's a track from that.
Great. Unfortunately, to see Tim or no Tim in the 80s, but certainly, you know, in the last 10 years since I've moved to the city, I've seen Tim play dozens and dozens of times, and at the old CBGBs, seeing Paraphrase with Tom Rainey and Drew Gress was pretty influential in terms of how to improvise, so I'd like to maybe play a little track from that.
You know, and I think maybe in the notes for this podcast, we'll put a link to, a YouTube clip of Night Music of Tim playing with, what is that?
He's
playing with Dave Sanborn, right?
He's playing with David Sanborn and Mark Dresser, Joey Barron with some cool glasses.
Which, this is radio or podcast, so you won't be able to see the glasses unless you go to the
link. Yeah, really. And Herb Robertson, and there was a guitar player that I did not recognize when I was looking at the, and I'm trying to figure out who it was.
I think you mean Alan Jaffe, who
Alan
was
Jaffe.
In Slickaphonics.
Yes,
I think
with Ray Anderson and Mark Elias.
We'll have to ask Tim and check.
Oh, and if I'm not mistaken, that sound we just heard.
I don't know what that was. These things just come out of the deep.
Yes.
A noise from the deep. The Greenleaf Music Podcast. Here we are.
And I think that means it's time for tour bus chatter.
Is that what that means? Okay. It seems to mean a different thing every time it happens. But yes, tour bus chatter. I have a pretty nerdy one this week. It's this story that has kind of been everywhere in the media about a television show in Norway that's called Firewood Night in Norway. It's kind of like Hockey Night in Canada, but it's about firewood. Have you heard about this?
Admittedly, no.
You really haven't?
I have not.
I can't believe it.
But I have, you know, there are a lot of things I miss.
You know, we have a wood stove here at the house, and so it was just interesting to me that the whole nation is obsessed with firewood, and it's the show where the first 4 hours they talk about chopping and stacking and splitting and
which you were intimately,
how do you stack your firewood, and very important in the first 4 hours, and then the second 8 hours of the show is just watching the fire burn.
Oh, okay.
And people, not like the Yule log. This is like, you know, somebody live feeding the fire every 20 minutes or so, and they move the stick, and people are watching it like suspensefully waiting, you know,
the log.
When are they going to put the next log? Oh, it's going to go out, you know, they better poke it, you know, kind of thing.
That's not unlike the Yule log show when they come in with the poker.
I guess so.
But... wow.
I guess so, but it's really a national...
And what is the allure of this show?
We should get some of these fantastic Norwegian musicians to come on, and actually, maybe they couldn't care less. But to me, it was really sort of this interesting story that you could have a 12-hour television show that's only about firewood, and it's actually that it's a success. It's not like this obscure thing. It's like there was a book about it called Solid Wood, the Norwegian... obsession with firewood, and maybe I'm making a bigger deal of it than it really is, but I just thought it was a funny story, and I think I'm going to get cut off with that sound again.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, so, you know, this is a music podcast, and so we're contractually obligated to talk about musical issues every now and then.
Yes.
Not to make too light of it, but, you know, you and I have done a lot of practicing over the years, and I know that you're always working on something new, so I was going to ask you what you had to bring to the table. This week.
Oh, you mean like a practice?
Yeah, like what are you working on, or what do you suggest something that somebody could do, a musician or not?
Sure.
To work on.
Well, you know, I'm a double bass player, and I like to play with the bow a lot. And I've had a strange revelation with one chords, four chords, and five chords in the last little while.
That's the blues.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it also is a naturally occurring phenomenon in mm-hmm. nature, which mm-hmm. is what I find really fascinating.
Like the harmonic series.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I get up in the morning and I've been sort of experimenting with different ways to practice my scales and making them more like pieces, a little more interesting. So taking just a C major scale and harmonizing it with one or two other notes and harmonizing it as a one chord or a four chord in this case, because that note only exists in those two chords, and going on to a D and harmonizing that with two notes, and it could be a five chord because of the D, mm-hmm. and it would say a G7 chord. Mm-hmm. And then going on to an E, and it could be a one chord again, and harmonizing it as a one chord, going on to an F four chord, or the flat seven of the five chord, and so on and so forth. And I think if you experiment with that, you end up with kind of a beautiful, simple sounding piece that has a motion that makes, you know, playing scales much more of a musical experience. And then, you know, and so I would go all the way up to the top and then come back down relative minor.
Ooh.
And the cool thing about the relative minor is that you have all three minor scales available to you. Mm. So you can have the natural seven, the flat seven, the flat six, and the natural six. So you can go down in different ways and harmonize each note of the scale.
Each note differently.
Wow. Hopefully that's clear.
It's probably confusing to me and others, but I think it's also, what's interesting about it is like that's a really great ear opener.
Yes,
too.
And like, I've found that has really changed how I'm dealing with harmony in a solo context, especially.
Wow, that's great. Why don't we go out, leave this episode with a piece of your music, And we'll just say one more time that this is A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. And I'm Dave Douglas.
And I'm Michael Bates.
Thank you for listening. All right. We'll be back soon.